The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. I'm here with the head sommelier for Maple Sports and Entertainment. It is Ann Martin. Ann, thanks so much for being part of the pod.
My pleasure. I'm very excited to be here, Matt.
I rarely do this. I'm actually going to start with a really stupid question. You've taken
me. There's no such thing as a stupid question.
This feels like a stupid question. Where are we sitting? This is not the stupid question. This is coming in a second. Where are we sitting right now for the listeners?
We are sitting in the what we sort of call the champagne room of the Platinum Club in the Scotiabank Arena.
How many different eating venues did you take me through a tour just before we started this?
So for our fine dining clubs, we have three. Two are membership only, Scotia Club and Platinum Club, and one is open to all, which is the Hot Stove Club on the second floor.
And this is now leads to my stupid question. Are these places open on non-game days? Because today, as we are recording this on January 24th, there is no Leafs game. They won last night against the Islanders. The Raptors are off, but they're in California taking on Sacramento. Are these restaurants open on non-game days?
No, they are not. And in fact, in order to get into them currently, you have to have a ticket.
And I bring that up because these places are gorgeous.
Oh,
and
thank you.
These are incredible wine lists. And I was just looking around at just the great Bordeaux section. I see some Tom Eddy, eye spotting some good Cru Beaujolais. And I can't help but thinking to myself, this space needs to be used on this Tuesday night. This place is gorgeous.
Well, we do rent them out for private events. But unfortunately, because of the nature of the game and concert schedule,
right,
it's ever-changing.
Yeah.
So big companies want long-term sort of commitments. So sometimes we do have last-minute parties, and we do have parties.
Yeah, okay. And see, that was my dumb question, because I'm like, oh, wait. Because I knew, I'm like, no, that's not open here. And then my head went, well, it should be. It should be open. At 7:30, someone should be here with a prime rib and a club roti.
I said the same thing when I saw them, but then I started to understand after I saw the event schedule and realized how it works.
Right. And that would just be tough with staffing, schedule, and also just produce or just having product that's fresh.
No, committing to the date. Mm. The venue committing to the date.
Right.
So when a concert comes in, they buy out the entire building. So let's say a corporation had rented Hot Stove for a corporate dinner and a concert booked, then it would no longer be the corporation's.
Your journey into becoming a sommelier. Let's go back a little bit. How did it get started for you?
Well, I started out as a chef. So I started as a chef. I studied at George Brown. I did a full apprenticeship at a place called the Millcroft Inn, which is still in existence, but was very different in those days, run by a Swiss German chef. So very proper sort of apprenticeship. And then I worked my way through various restaurants in Toronto and ended up in a very high-end catering company doing all the big parties, including the Economic Summit. And then I went on a trip. I applied for and was accepted for a program called Operation Rally, which was a program that brought youth from around the world to work in various countries. And I chose Kenya, was in Africa traveling. And I didn't want to come back. I decided I didn't want to come back. So I was born in England. Mm-hmm. And when I went to the embassy, they said, well, you're not eligible for citizenship. But I took a chance because I thought that probably wasn't true, and went to England and got citizenship and worked there. So I started in cheese. I actually worked for a really amazing cheese company. I just decided I wanted to get out of the back of house. I loved cooking, but I wasn't the best chef. You have to be of a certain temperament, and you have to be, especially as a woman, you have to be pretty hard. Mm-hmm. And that just isn't really my
right
way. Yeah. And I also love being with people and in the front of house. So I worked in the cheese shop, which was great. It's called Neil's Yard. It was the cheese shop featured in the Monty Python cheese sketch. Oh,
okay.
Because they had their offices close by in Neil's Yard in Covent Garden in London. And then I roasted coffee. for a very famous coffee place called Monmouth Coffee, which is now the go-to for all the sort of baristas if you're doing a sort of apprenticeship program. And then I decided, well, I've done coffee and cheese, I should try wine. And there's nowhere better to study wine than London.
Yeah.
Because the English love to drink. They get, everything is imported. They have everything at their fingertips in terms of the quality and quantity of wine.
Because they're so close to France, they're so close to Germany, so close to Spain. It's all right there. And, I mean, they had such a history of it. I think they were the ones who came up with the nickname Claret. I mean, they decided that Bordeaux wine would have another nickname that they would come up with.
That, well, because they're big fans of wine and beer. And they have a really knowledgeable, they travel all the time, they have a very knowledgeable sort of populace in terms of wine. So I did do some WSET courses. I then started campaigning to get into a company called Oddbins, which was at that time owned by Seagram's and was probably the top place to work and learn about wine. And I did, and it was amazing. And I worked in some of the top shops in London. And I've probably never learned more about wine than I did then, because not only were we exposed to all this incredible wine and selling wine from first growths down to what's your cheapest $2.99 bottle,
right,
which you can do in Europe. It was populated by people from all over the world, it was staffed by people from all over the world that were the same. So we wrote talkers on all the wine, and everybody was into it, and we also tasted all the time. So it was an incredible learning ground.
How much better is $10 wine in Europe than $10 wine in North America?
Well, I think there's no comparison, really. I mean, let's say we just go euro for dollar. I think you can do much better. Or pound for dollar, which is what it works out to when you live there. There's no comparison. And we have a cap in Ontario, too, put on by the LCBO. So that changes things.
Did you have a bottle that you loved? It's one of my stock questions, but was, you know, you went from cheese to coffee to wine, which makes a ton of sense just in terms of it is an item that is wildly popular that has so many different manifestations. So it makes a lot of sense to go from them. Was there a bottle or a moment when you're like, okay, yes, it's time for me to learn or get more into vino?
Well, I mean, it is hilarious because initially, when I lived there, I lived with my cousins who were very into wine and had an amazing collection, and we were having wonderful wine every night, and I had really no idea. But then I started living on my own, and I would buy the big wine. London at that time was Bulgarian Red. Mm. It was $2.99.
And Bulgarian Red, so mixed varietals.
Mixed varietals from Bulgaria.
Yeah.
$2.99.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, you have to remember, I was working as a shop assistant in London. You don't have a lot of money. And then I had a friend who worked with somebody, or who was very good friends with somebody that imported a lot of Spanish wine. And I was lucky enough to taste a Vega Sicilia 78.
Okay.
And that was that.
Yeah.
I mean, it was easy for me to learn about wine, too. I was a chef.
Right.
I understood smells. I understood nuances. I understood that smell indicates certain things. It was very easy for me to pick up on wine. What was difficult for me was the wine knowledge, because I was working with Europeans and it's all there for them. And this was classic training, too.
Right.
It's not like today where other regions have risen to the fore. This was like you needed to know France, you needed to know Italy, you needed to know Spain in depth.
Yeah, so your training, you know, you said you took some, you took a bunch of courses with WSET or the Quartermaster, but I mean, what incredible training you had working as a chef back house, working in cheese, working in coffee. It's funny, in a lot of ways, you were, even before you decided to get into wine, you were already sort of training your senses for the career that you have now.
Yeah, I was training it was obviously something that I was quite interested in, but it sort of came to the fore with all these experiences.
So then how do you go from Oddbins in London to now being in charge of just a massive amounts.
A hockey arena?
A hockey arena, a basketball arena. Yeah, how do you go from London, England to the Leafs and the Raptors?
Well, you know, I always call it lily pad hopping rather than a straight a straight line of a career. So I came back to Canada after 6 years in England, and there wasn't much going on with wine. So
what year was this? Around
94.
Okay, yeah.
95. So there were no sommeliers really in any restaurants. There wasn't really a wine scene as there is now. People were drinking wine, but it wasn't like it is now. And I went back to being a chef, and I was a private chef for the Eatons because I had contacts from my catering days. And
right.
That's what I ended up doing. And I started doing some more wine courses just to meet people in the wine business. I worked, you know, I did a course with David Lorison. I did another WSET course, just kind of kept my wine knowledge going and met the owner of Prego della Piazza, Michael Carlebelle. And after we had done our wine course together, which I passed and he failed, I said, would you like me to come? I don't think there was, I mean, it's not that Michael couldn't have passed, it's just that he wasn't entirely focused. I said, I'd like to come and run your wine program. And he's like, well, what experience do you have in front of house? And I said, well, enough, and bluffing my way through it, of course, because I hadn't really worked in the front of house. So then went to be a manager at Prego della Piazza and run the wine program there. And he had an amazing cellar, but it was a very chaotic and crazy place to work.
Right.
So I learned a lot.
Yeah.
Quickly.
What do you think it was that way back in the mid-90s? Why was it Canada was so far behind? Is it just because we didn't have as much access to the great wines of Europe just because of travel, and back then no real internet, so harder to get the information? Like, I hear this all the time, it feels like the mid-90s doesn't feel that long ago.
No,
but it feels like complete backwater time.
It was,
you know, Clinton's second term as president doesn't feel that long ago, but it feels like it just, the wine world was almost in the Middle Ages here.
Well, I think it's the Canadian sort of way. My parents didn't drink wine with dinner. They would drink wine on special occasions. And in fact, my dad made wine from grapes.
Right.
So they were interested in wine, but it wasn't part of the milieu, part of the culture. And I think Prohibition had a lot to do with that too. Like, liquor stores were, walk into a store and there's no product.
Yeah.
How can you buy or be interested in something when it's like that? And it was sort of seen as something snooty. So there's that sort of side to it as well. And I guess it's was expensive, probably, relatively speaking, compared to Europe. So maybe all of those things added up.
Yeah, no, you're right. And we do have a draconian / paternalist, or the LCBO, I always say this, is kind of has a draconian / paternalistic feeling about how they, you know, their relationship with some wine consumers. Of course, you said about the prices. I always hate when I go back if someone says, here, look at the menu of prices for wine from the mid-90s, and I just get angry and want to invent a time machine. Okay, so now, and then I read that at one point then you were, so then how do you go from there to working at Canoe, that people might not know, very famous restaurant, top of the TD Tower, gorgeous place, incredible reputation. And, you know, I've been there only a couple times, but had, you know, spectacular meals to go with a really good view.
Well, I guess one of the things, what happened was I got married and we moved to Cayman and worked there for a couple of years in the hospitality business. And there is nothing going on in wine there or was. So I guess when I came back, I've always believed in going for the best. If you're going to do it, just get in at the bottom and work your way up.
Right.
Like, don't
Hence,
waste.
You're at Odbin's.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. I've always believed, and Neil's Yard and Monmouth Coffee House, those are incredibly famous places now, because it's worth it. If you show the enthusiasm, and you'll probably convince people, and if you work hard, you'll probably convince people that you're the right stuff. So I just bothered them they said, well, you know, we will put you in at Biff's as a sommelier, but then the person who was doing it hadn't moved on. And I finally said to the sort of regional manager, look, I'm interested in working for you guys. You need to make a decision. I at this point had been the first female somm in Toronto. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I have skills, but I'm willing to be a server. Just give me something. I'll do whatever you want.
Right.
So I started serving at Auberge. And then I became an assistant manager. And then the canoe somm was left and I was there, ready to go.
You mentioned before, and I should have probably started with this, but just being the first sommelier in Toronto, that was it?
Female.
Female, sorry. Yeah. Yes, the first female.
Because at that point, there was Alain at Canoe, there was Peter Boyd at Scaramouche, and there was somebody at the CN Tower as well. Yeah.
Was it incredibly gratifying? Was it nervous? Was it intimidating first? I mean, whenever you're the first for something, that especially, I mean, that's a hell of an accomplishment. I mean, there must have been a wide range of emotion.
No, I mean, to me, it was simply what I did.
Right.
Sometimes there were nerves, but it was the way of the business. If I went on to a tasting, I would be the only woman in the room. It was simply sort of the way it was. But the great thing about being a sommelier is you have a special set of skills and you usually work alone.
Right.
So I wasn't generally contested when I was in my doing my thing.
How different is it now? We'll get back to your journey, but this just...
You want to talk about restaurant management being a woman? That's a whole other kettle of fish.
How different is it now? And we'll do this on two levels. One, just the role of women in the wine world from the mid-90s. And then just how different... And you know what? Let's just start there. How different is the role of women in the wine industry in 2023 versus, say, back in 95, 96?
Night and day.
Yeah.
It's completely changed. In a great way. It's really opened up. There are lots of women writers, lots of women master somms, lots of women making wine, lots of women in the export, in the trade part of it, which is an important part as well, because that was for a long time really dominated by men.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, some countries are a little bit more behind.
Yeah.
And then female somms have it. That's just exploded.
Yeah. And it makes sense. There's no... This is one of my parts of how naive I was. When I was studying with WSET, going all through the diploma, just in my class, it was as many women as men. I think sometimes it was more women than men. And some of the most impressive people that I've had on the pod and that I studied with and amazed me are all women. And I think, you know, maybe just the blinders of just being a guy and not really thinking about it. I didn't realize that in the somm world that there was such a gap and that there was, you know, just all these barriers. Because to me, it just, all I was surrounded by really, really smart, talented women. And I had blinders on. I didn't realize just how much of a barrier was out there.
Yeah, I think in Canada, it was always a little bit better because we've always been a bit more open to outliers, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Kind of, well, I guess it's okay because it wasn't really a culture here.
Yeah.
So,
right. It's almost like you're not dealing with the baggage of, you know, you go to some parts of Europe.
Yeah,
yeah. France or Germany or things like that where it's
always been a man.
Passed down from the man to the son.
So I guess that's a great point. It was a sign of that time in the 90s where there was nothing going on. And then the world very quickly changed and it was acceptable for women to have so many jobs that it just slotted in a little bit more easily than... That's not to say there aren't issues and...
Of course.
But that's the same in every job.
Was there any... What do you think changed with the wine industry in... We'll just stay in Toronto or Ontario. Like, was it just inevitable that eventually we get to where we are now, where there's tons of wine bars, and I can go to places and find, you know, funky Austrian reds, and, you know, so many places have somms, and you see more prominent wine cellars, and not as nice as here, but you see more prominent wine cellars where it's just much more normalized now.
I think it started slowly. For a long time, the education in Toronto was not great, and then that improved. The court came here, which has allowed more and more people to do it. Caps improved, became more of a thing. And restaurants started to see the value of somms and hire people to be sommeliers. Not usually just the sommelier, but So that was kind of like a groundswell. But then I think it's television, food shows, the internet,
right,
the whole sort of like exposure to what's cool. Now it's celebrities have, you know, hey, Martha Stewart has her own wine.
Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie before they got divorced.
Yeah,
like Rosé.
It's funny that so many people don't realize that was their winery. That's the funniest thing. That didn't really, Canada, didn't seem to have, I'll tell people that and they'll be like, oh, I had no idea.
Wait, they always owned it? Or
yeah, they've always owned it.
Oh, okay. I thought it was like a phenomenon that came within the last couple of years of their marriage.
Well, I'm sorry, they haven't owned it probably since it was begun, but they've owned it for at least 10 years.
Oh, okay. Oh,
so yeah, a lot of it, but now it, you know, it's become like Snoop Dogg and,
yes,
you know, it's like a whole rosé is in.
Yeah.
Like it's kind of fun and I really enjoy that side of it. And I think the rise of natural wine caused the explosion in wine bars.
Mm-hmm.
So the rise of natural wine is very appealing to younger wine drinkers.
Yes.
And that was important for the wine business to change in that way, to keep a young demographic,
right,
like feeding in. Otherwise, we'd be like, I'm trying to think of a wine. Like, unfortunately, German wine, which is probably my favorite one. Riesling is my favorite grape.
Oh, wait, if I can interrupt. It took the 22-minute mark before yet another guest proclaimed German Riesling as the best. And I laugh about this because back in May, what did I want to do for my birthday? I went and traveled to Mosul and Rheingau. And yes, for everyone listening, I apologize. And I'm going to apologize to Anne because I bet she's done this at parties. I've done this as well. But everyone out there, drink more German Riesling. You numbskulls. the sugar. Have you seen the sugar in your mass-produced California Pinot?
Yeah.
Get out of there.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
Everything always goes back
there.
But that's interesting. Okay, I promise we're going to get back to the ACC and the Raptors and Leafs and everything. But now we're just going off on other topics. I never thought about the idea that the rise of wine bars was sort of linked to natural wine. I'm someone who, you know, I'm always a little cynical of natural wine because sometimes I wonder how much of it is just about marketing.
If not natural wine, certainly lower intervention wine,
right,
and smaller producers and,
yeah,
you know, just sort of that
farm-to-table sort of.
Farm-to-table,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, that
exactly.
Makes total sense.
And then also I would love to throw out some applause or kudos to the Ontario wine industry. There were certain players that came in and started to really improve the wines in Niagara and in Prince Edward County.
Oh, yeah.
And that, I think people love that now. They love going to Niagara. And the prejudice that older drinkers had about Ontario wine is not present in younger drinkers, which is great.
Yes.
I think it's awesome.
Do you ever... do you ever get tempted when you have, and we'll just go the stereotype of the older, more conservative wine drinker, nothing wrong with loving the hits. We all love the hits. I was staring at your old Bordeaux's. But do you ever get tempted to go, oh, okay, let me pour you this Chardonnay. Oh, I know it's not white Burgundy, but it's something close and I love it. And you go, okay, that's Prince Edward County. Or the same thing with a Pinot or a Bordeaux blend from Okanagan or a Two Sisters Merlot.
Between Canoe and here, I had my own company doing tastings,
yeah,
and I was a wine writer. And when I do tastings, I will always do 4 wines, and one of them will always be on Ontario wine.
Yeah,
because I do want to prove to people that this is something you need to be trying.
Yeah,
this is something fun in your own backyard.
And also go back and check out Anne's old work in Toronto Life, and she does have an article about how to read a German wine label. I think that's from around 2013.
Oh, wow.
And the archives are still there. Good on you, Toronto Life. No paywall. But if you want to do a paywall, I understand, because journalists need to get paid. But that's a subject for another day. Okay, so how do you go from Canoe to the ACC? I'm assuming it was because of your lifelong love of the Maple Leafs in the 80s and 90s.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
Actually, my brother and I used to fight on Friday nights about whether we were going to, or Saturday, I guess it
Saturdays.
Was Saturday,
yeah.
Who was going to watch the movie and who was, because we only had one TV.
Yep.
I'm definitely dating myself, but anyway, there were, World War III would ensue,
yes,
and my brother thinks it's hilarious that I now work for MLSE. I started my own business. I had a son. So I couldn't work nights. So I started my own business doing wine tastings, et cetera, et cetera. And when you have your own business, you always need a little extra cash. And a friend of mine, Sarah D'Amato, who's quite a famous wine writer, said, you know, you really should come and work with Jen. They're at, you know, work with us, because she was working here part-time. And I said, I don't know. I mean, like, I'm just thinking, what is it? But Jen had been here a long time, and I've known Jen for years. So she just invited me to a staff meeting. And I thought, this is great. Like, it's a great environment. It's a little different from restaurants. And then she said, just come and work a game. So I worked a game.
What was that like?
In what was then the Scotia Club, or what is now the Scotia Club, but then the Air Canada Club, on a opening night Montreal game. And at that time, we seated more people in there, and it was insane, and I loved it.
Yeah.
I was like, everybody's here to have fun, and they're drinking tons of wine, and I'm popping bottles all over the place, and people don't care they're not asking, so when did this restaurant start, and who's the chef? They're just here to have fun.
Right.
And I thought, this is a really fun place to work.
It's Chris Zielinski said the same thing. Just the one difference is that, and now maybe
he's a huge sports fan.
Yeah, but this is about emotion, because you know when you work at a restaurant, you can't always be guaranteed that everyone's coming in for fun. Sometimes they're coming from something somber. So everyone here, they might leave upset,
but even when they're upset, they're not. Having a domestic or something.
Yeah, it's not, we lost the business, I got divorced, you know, I just got the bad news from the doctor. The bad news is the Leafs penalty kill stunk.
Right. Yeah. And that feeling of, and that's something, because I wasn't a sports fan, that I've come to love and enjoy, and now I get it. And I've learned a lot about sports and just sports culture. That feeling of everybody rising up together is really unique.
Right.
And, you know, you see that in concerts, obviously, as well. So it's really fun. That's what I love about it.
It's been fun for you because, I don't want to use the term interloper, but certainly someone from outside the hardcore sports fanatic culture. And then for you just to sort of observe it and learn it and absorb it in a very different way than probably your brother did. So what is it like? What is the day in the life like of being the head sommelier for Maple Leaf Sports and Entertainment?
It starts early, mm-hmm. contrary to what everybody thinks. So there's a lot of email, there's a lot of wine business, but there's also a lot of department business and keeping the business. Because I don't just oversee the restaurants. I also, in this stadium, I also oversee the beverage program at 11 and Real Sports. We also have our global partners who do our deals, and they have events. I also oversee the wine partnership. I also oversee the partnership with Molson. So there are a lot of elements to the job that kind of keep it rolling. Currently, I'm lining up a Diageo, a Don Julio tasting for some staff with Diageo, and, you know, it's just kind of like never ending. And plus, I manage a team of 12 to 14 somms.
Yeah.
So that's
like, that's a lot.
It's a lot.
Yeah.
It's the herding of the cats, I call it. And they're great. I always hire people who are self-starters, really good at, I have to be able to trust them. I cannot be in all of these rooms all the time.
No, you gave me the tour, and it's this restaurant. And yeah, I mean, you'd be basically doing a couple marathons a day to try to keep up with every nook and cranny at the Scotiabank Arena.
So it's my job to guide it and to make sure that put the right people in place to do what needs to be done. So yeah, it starts out with a bunch of emails. Then I usually do a walk or some exercise, and then I come in on a game day. Make sure that everything, because by this time all the orders will be starting to come in the back. So we have a warehouse in the back because these sellers all draw from that warehouse. Mm-hmm. Probably communications with the warehouse to make sure things are, or with agents to make sure things are arriving. And then at 4 o'clock we have our pre-shift briefings, just making sure everybody's here, possibly being at some of the briefings to make some points. And then service starts. And I firmly believe that it's very important for a sommelier to be on the floor some of the time, because that's how you really understand what's happening in a restaurant.
Right.
So I'm often here on the floor. usually in Platinum. Sometimes if we're short, I'll work in one of the other rooms. And that's usually, I don't stay till the end, but usually till 9 or 10. And so it's a during the season, it's intense.
Yeah, that must be. And also, we were talking this a little before, but the dining experience is so different. It's not the 3.5 hour linger. I mean, unless you get there right off the top. Even that, you can't do that. And we're going to let the bottle decant for 4 hours. Like, this is a very different environment for high-end, because this is high-end dining, but it's high-end dining when...
That's the thing.
Yeah, it's high-end dining, but people want to get out by 7:05 to be there for puck drop.
So I guess it's comparable to pre-theater, but we still want the elevated experience with the knowledge that a lot of these people are spending, you know, big money on tickets, and they're excited to have a full experience. So it's quick, but it's still fine dining. And what I always hire people that have a fine dining background, restaurant background, or sort of are clued into that, but like to work quickly. There are some people that do really enjoy that. Let me tell you all about this wine. And I'm like, you've got to do it in, like, quickly, sound bites, and then away to the next table.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, this is different. Probably most of the diners here, they're not here for the 30-minute conversation about this tiny little Beaujolais producer where it's a husband and wife team. They started 7 years ago because one was a scientist and one was a farmer.
Right. Yeah. And not that the Somms I hired don't know that.
Yeah, they don't.
And they're certainly, and sometimes, like, people will stay during the game.
Yeah,
and there are times for these conversations. And
yeah,
it's a fun. Most of them really enjoy that aspect of it as well.
How long ago did you join? Did you join up with MLSE?
So I started 2 years, 12 years ago, part time for 2, and now 10.
How different is the wine program and the hospitality here now versus when you started part-time?
Well, I mean, it had a great foundation. Jen did a wonderful job of setting it up.
Yeah.
But it's expanded. It's much bigger than it was in terms of when I started. That was 10 years ago full-time. Raptors games were not a thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, I could usually leave and we would have one Somm in here.
Right.
Now Raptors games are as busy as Leaf games in this room particularly. And I guess the interest in wine has grown. I mean, the foundation was there, so people know it's here. And so I think when I started, there were 5 or 6 of us, and now there are 10 to 12 of us.
Right, yeah.
And on the Somm team, so.
Can you tell, is there a difference at all in terms of wine palate for the Raptor fan versus the Maple Leaf fan?
Yeah. There is. There's a big difference. Leaf fans are more traditional. I mean, it goes with the crowd.
Right.
Leaf fans are more traditional. They're very into Californian cab. They're very into bigger Italians. Mm-hmm. A little more mostly red. We do sell 80% red here.
Right.
I mean, given it's winter and it's the demographic. And then Raptor fans are more open to suggestion, and they do drink more white.
I bet you enjoy. I mean, you enjoy both, obviously, but at the very least, with the Raptor crowd, maybe someone asks for a white Southern Rhone, and it's like, okay, fun. Let's
sell a Viognier for sure.
Yeah. And would you say it's, in terms of total sales, is it the same? Is there one that's more? Is there one crowd that's more than the other?
Leafs? Because it's all three. It's the full building.
Right.
Whereas for Raptors fans, they're more on the event level. Mm-hmm. But also, I think people have changed the way that they enjoy wine, and they take it to the game as well. So that's a big, you know, that adds up to the, you know, they want to drink good wine in their seats.
Yeah.
We even have a little, like, you can buy wine courtside from here.
Yeah.
Just like a short list. And Somm will run out. And
really?
Yeah.
So if you're courtside, you can get like Cote Roti if you're sitting courtside.
You could request it. Yeah. The list I have doesn't have it on it.
Right.
So one of the things, but you could request it and we would bring it out.
Right.
Yes. Because it's all licensed. It's under the same license. But that, yeah, it is. There was something I was going to say, and it just went out of my mind. Hopefully it'll come back.
Yeah, it'll come back in a minute. And
oh, I know what I was going to say is that I don't buy wine for my palate. Mm-hmm. So yes, I do love German Riesling.
Yes.
But we have one on the list, and that's
what is
just,
the one? What is the one?
It's that the Kreismann Cabinet.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Yeah.
Well, no, and two, and a Marcus Molitor Spätlese. But yeah.
I went. I'm actually trying to set up an interview with someone from Marcus Molitor.
Oh, cool. I actually think I know someone that works there.
Yeah, they're Ashlezi. Again, if you're listening, find their older Ashlezis, drink them. Again, don't worry, oh no, sugar. It's not going to hurt you.
Just get yourself some Thai food, you'll be fine.
Yeah, exactly. But it must be interesting just when you got started versus now that I imagine maybe this is more on the Raptor side, that there are people asking for a greater variety of wines than what would have been in
so
like the mid-2000s.
So the white Burgundy definitely expanded.
Right.
And Chablis has become quite a thing, which is kind of sad given that there's not a lot of it around now.
No. Yeah.
And it's easier to move people away from Pinot Grigio, which is great.
Yep.
Not that there's anything wrong with Pinot Grigio, but it's just a mass-produced white isn't going to offer you the nuances that something that so many other whites can.
It's not like that there's anything against Pinot Grigio. It's that when someone always only orders Pinot Grigio.
That I don't understand.
That is the issue. Yeah. Like when it's I'll have a glass of white. What was that? I'll just have the Pinot Grigio. It's like, you haven't even looked at the list.
Well, for me, it's just like, do you want to eat the same thing every day?
Yeah.
What? Like there's a world of wine.
Yes.
And it's so exciting. And I understand it can be intimidating, but that's what sommeliers are here for. And we're here to make people happy.
Yeah.
I would never preach to you what you should drink. I would simply ask, what do you like to drink? Are you open to possibly tasting something else?
Yeah.
And I think you might be really pleasantly surprised. And if you're not, I'll take it away.
Yeah. How important is that with staff training about just that it's just instilling that ethos?
Very.
Yeah.
Extremely. So, you know, I've just tasked the SOM team with doing a test for the servers in here. We've had a challenging year just with staffing issues.
Yeah.
So it's a bit late in the season, but, you know, it's still a good time to do it. So one of the questions, and I get them to do it because they're the ones in the floor and understand what needs to be tweaked. And I get one of the questions was, you know, what do you do if a guest complains about the wine? Ignore them. Was A, say, I think it's fine.
No.
And then, of course, the right answer is just bring it to the SOM station and the SOM will go over and sort it out.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, it is great. I mean, and you write, you know, I've seen you say in interviews and on your website, and it's the same thing with this pod. The main rule is to make wine, demystify it, de-intimidate it. Wine is meant to be fun. It's meant to be enjoyed. It's food. It's an item. Sometimes you can brood over it. Sometimes you don't have to think about it at all.
And that's the fun of it.
Yes.
And that's the fun of life. So, and the thing about wine is that it does speak so much to life. It comes from places. It comes from people. It's one of the only products outside of cheese that you can actually taste where it comes from, and that's exciting.
Yeah.
But you don't have to know that to enjoy it.
Well, as long as, tastes good. Tastes good with this beef short rib. Great. And here's hoping the Raptors can do better in terms of rebounding.
Okay, if they're not, I'll just have another bottle.
Yes.
That's the other great thing about it. It's consoling.
Oh, yeah. I hang out with a lot of my friends who are all sports fans and also wine fans. And, yes, it can be very consoling. I know we got to wrap this up because I had all these other questions. We're not going to get to them just because we went in tangents, which I'm glad we did. How different is it for you and for the staff, the regular season versus the postseason?
So during the postseason, the team doesn't really work. Mm-hmm. One of my SOMs will handle the concerts because that goes on through the summer usually.
Postseason, like playoffs.
Oh, playoffs. Yes, playoffs are exciting.
That's why when you said, oh, there's no one working at postseason, what are you talking about?
So that's
like the Raptors when they won the title.
Well, that was amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, that was a once in a lifetime experience. Like, I mean, hopefully not a once in a lifetime, but a lifetime experience. It was so intense and crazy and you felt like you were just part of something bigger. And then I called it Champagne Gate or Bubble Gate. Operation Bubbles, that's what I called it.
And what is Operation
Bubbles? Operation Bubbles was when we had to bring in all the Prosecco that was going to be served on the buses. Mm-hmm. And the getting our wine partner to get enough of the Prosecco to supply.
Yeah.
And then hiding it because you're not supposed to. There is a lot of superstition around playoffs.
Right. Yes.
And also they do print cans with the team on it, but those also have to be hidden. So it's
you
a
can't
whole
have a player or a coach see that before.
No,
it's
and actually our owner, Mr. Tannenbaum, is very superstitious.
So yeah.
Yeah. So that was exciting. Yeah. And then getting that, we had to get all of that Prosecco over to BMO because that's where the buses were coming from.
Mm-hmm. And this was for the parade.
For the parade. Yeah. And we wanted to do that before that, I think it was a Monday. Mm-hmm. Was it Monday?
We had to do it over
the weekend anyway to get it done because there was going to be, all the streets were going to be.
Yeah.
And then they ran out.
And then they ran out. And then we had to hand bomb it
onto the bus through the crowd with police holding back the crowd and people saying, I've been standing here for hours. And you're like, but they need more champagne. It's sparkling.
Yes.
You know it.
I like how you switch from champagne to sparkling.
And it was not champagne.
Yeah.
Although people funnily thought it was. But the brand that we used has a very similar label to Veuve.
Okay. Yeah.
So great publicity for them.
Mm-hmm. Very, very smart.
Yeah.
Very smart. Have you ever had any encounters with players or coaches, or, and maybe you can't even talk about it, just about ones like where like, wow, that player, or you don't have to give a name, but where you were surprised that a player or a coach loved, they're like, oh yeah, this one loves Shambu Moussini.
I have two good stories, and they're one's ongoing and one's very recent. So the first one is, I don't know if I'm allowed to say his name, but he has a lot to do with the Leafs.
Okay.
And he is very into a particular Italian wine. Mm-hmm. And so that is a constant fun thing for me, trying to source really great wines
right.
for him.
Yeah.
And it's just nice to know that somebody appreciates wine in that way.
What region?
Brunello.
Brunello? Okay. Yeah.
So, and then the other one was recently I was in one of my favorite wine spots, which is Peter Pan on Queen Street.
So good.
Yeah. And Nick, the man that runs it, is a friend of mine. And we were at a tasting of a natural wine producer just sitting. And this guy came and he said, you know, that's somebody from the Penguins. And I'm like, you mean the hockey team? And he's like, yes. I mean, he's Australian. He's not knowledgeable about hockey particularly, and I'm like, no. He's like, yes, he comes in here all the time, and he's really into wine, and he knows a lot about wine, and apparently he entertains the, you know, he takes wine on the, you know, he's educating his teammates.
Yeah.
So there's this big rise, from what I understand, amongst the players and interest in wine.
Yeah, and
it is. So that's kind of fun.
It is. It's cool. It went from, much like anywhere else, it went from, okay, just Camus or Opus 1 and just, you know, flex your dollar by showing what's in the biggest cab. And now it seems the flex is, oh yeah, no, I'm trying this stuff from Etna. That's incredible.
Well, so I did end up having a chat with him, and he was very knowledgeable about those smaller producers. And I think that's what I mean about the rise of natural wine and the rise of smaller producers, is that amongst younger wine drinkers, is it's really, it's become cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's exciting.
And I really appreciate this. We're now at the 45-minute mark, and you got 17 meetings and things to do.
Oh, well,
and I gotta fly up and actually talk about the Maple Leafs beating the Island? Yeah, it's the Islanders.
Yeah, that was an exciting game last night.
Yeah, that was fun. Nice for John Tavares to score. But I really appreciate this. And again, to everyone out there, if it's a game night, what's the earliest point you can come in here, sit at the bar, make a reservation at any of the restaurants here?
5 p.m.
Oh, 5 p.m.
So, and then you can also, if you have a reservation in here, come back in halftime during intermission, and that's a lot of fun too.
That's brilliant. Everyone, come here at 5, And then if you come right at 5, then you can have, you know, a full 2-hour dinner. And then you don't have to worry about parking or dealing with the gardener or the TTC or anything, because it is stunning. Like, you gave me a tour. It is gorgeous here, you know, and from Jennifer Huther, who's incredible, to yourself. I mean, just a testament to what you guys have done and the vision of people like Larry Tannenbaum and so many others to create this elevated wine experience and hospitality experience within the Scotiabank Arena. I think it's really incredible.
Thank you. It's been really fun speaking with you. Thanks for asking me to do this.
Oh, yeah. And again, thanks for taking the time. Thanks.
Pleasure.
Thanks for listening, everyone. This has been the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Stitcher, Spotify, iTunes, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.